Hello, dear friends. Welcome to another Alpha Bunga Bunga. We hope this episode finds you well. We hope you're taking care of yourselves, locked away wherever you might be, other than maybe our listeners in Sweden, who I think maybe aren't as quite locked away as other people are. Hiya, Swedes. Enjoy your freedom. Guys, what kind of social activities are you partaking in during this quarantine? Because my mind so far have extended to these to virtual pub quizzes every Friday. I did one for my brother's birthday last night.
Yeah, that sounds good.
I think it's legitimate to do based for your brother's birthday, but otherwise I'm trying to avoid that kind of so-called social participation.
That's good. Kill sociability like once and for all.
Well, what else do you get if you don't have parasocial contact like that? You know, just have talking over Skype with friends to record a podcast, which isn't enough. It's not enough for anyone.
Maybe if Zoom didn't exist, the rebellion would have happened already.
Still got Skype though. So
maybe if Skype didn't exist, the rebellion would happen.
Yeah, so, if that's a little bit like a kind of anti-consumerist take. Like, you know, if the people didn't have all these baubles and consumerist joys, they would have actually been communists. So it's Zoom. Zoom is oppressing the masses.
Exactly.
Repressive tolerance of Zoom. I'm doing another quiz tonight, which actually I'm running this one, and it's podcast style with me interviewing people about topics, and I'm calling it Alex Quizza Quizza. and that's not even a joke.
I'm not laughing because it's not a joke and it's not amusing.
But last night, I mean, just to show you how on brand I am all the fucking time, last night we my brother invited various different friends to pick a topic each, and everyone had to, you know, come up with five different questions based on that, on the theme that they picked. And, you know, there's a whole range of different things. Mine, I stayed on brand and I did one about Silvio Berlusconi. So I had five questions and I figured out, you know, will you guys know the answer to these if I read them out?
Maybe not, but go on.
No?
Let's see.
All right, so Silvio worked on a cruise ship in the 1960s. What was his job?
He was a piano player, singer.
An entertainer.
He was a crooner. Like a red coat. I accepted entertainer as one of the answers, though singer crooner was probably the most accurate answer. But yeah, what was Silvio's first political party called? I give a multiple choice just to kind of confuse people. But Bella Italia, Popolo della Libertà, Forza Italia, or Bello e Libero, being beautiful
Forza
and free.
Italia.
Last one. Yes.
Forza Italia. Yeah.
Yeah. Popolo della Libertà was later on. And then, so the question three was, which European statesperson did Berlusconi call an unfuckable fat ass?
Easy. Madame Merkel.
Madame Merkel, yeah. Frau Merkel, exactly. Horrible. One, instead of invading Iraq, Berlusconi suggested to George W. Bush what alternative? It's a bit of a trick.
It was something about going there and just having a good time in some way. I can't remember.
You'd think so, but no. Apparently, he had. I think this obviously only came out afterwards. But he suggested to him because he didn't really want to go along with the war, but then allowed, the U.S. to use the army bases. So anyway, what he actually suggested was he tried to talk to Gaddafi to accept Saddam in exile there, so that Saddam would leave. The idea being that Saddam would leave without a war and then would go take exile in Libya. I think Gaddafi wasn't on board with it, didn't happen, as we know. A little bit of random Berlusconi trivia there. And maybe of some political import, you know. I mean, obviously if it had come off. Right, then the final question was, according to Silvio, where did the phrase bunga bunga come from?
It's a joke. Like, you end up on a island and you're going to be eaten with cannibals. And it's a Scotsman and a somebody else, an Irishman, and they like put pineapples up your ass and this and that. But it was, I think,
I don't think that's exactly it. I don't think that's exactly it. But yeah, it's basically right. I mean, it's basically based on a joke. I don't know if it was Gaddafi. Yeah. I mean, it was certainly a joke which he'd heard about, whatever, kind of some kind of racist joke.
Is it really?
About
so
African
is that a joke?
Tribesmen.
Is that?
Yeah. Basically, the African bunga. Tribesmen go, do you want bunga bunga or do you want death? And the first guy goes, ooh, I'll have bunga bunga. And then they sexually have their way with the captive person and then kill him. And then the other guy goes, well, I'll take death. He's like, okay, but bunga bunga first. Ha 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 ha. It's not even a very good joke, man. Yeah, so that's it. That's supposedly where it comes from. I don't know. Is there a Gaddafi connection to it? Do all roads lead to Tripoli?
No, they do not.
Only the roads that lead from Tripoli are also lead to Tripoli. It's dialectics.
That's not dialect. Anyway, so... Sure.
For Bunga Bunga, all roads lead to Rome, as they always have. So there you go.
Right, there we go.
Well, we're giving a new meaning to the phrase death by Bunga Bunga, aren't we?
Yeah. That's actually pretty good.
Is it? Shall we get started with the actual main course here? Right. Three courses, because it's three articles. The regular listeners will know the deal. Hello to new subscribers. I guess I should explain what the format is. It's very simple. We each bring a different article to discuss. It's a bit like a show and tell thing. Remember those from school? And we introduce the article and discuss it. We try to bring them all based on the same theme. And because in our current times, there is only one theme that exists in the world, which is coronavirus, these ones will be about coronavirus, its impact, and the politics of it. So let's get started. George is doing the first one. George, go ahead.
Yeah. So I picked an article by the Financial Times editorial board. So this was the 3rd of April. Virus lays bare the frailty of the social contract. So in this, they argue that radical reforms are required to forge a society that will work for all. And it's worth, I mean, it's a short editorial. It's worth reading if you haven't already. I think many listeners will have got wind of this on either by reading it directly or seeing people discuss it. But I think it's an important one to go through, even if relatively quickly. So the article begins. If there is a silver lining to the COVID-19 pandemic, it is that it has injected a sense of togetherness into polarized societies. But the virus and the economic lockdowns needed to combat it also shine a glaring light on existing inequalities and even create new ones. So they continue, as Western leaders learnt in the Great Depression and after the Second World War, to demand collective sacrifice, you must offer a social contract that benefits everybody. And then, despite inspirational calls for national mobilization, we're not really all in this together. Those in low-wage jobs can still work. Those in low-wage jobs who can still work are often risking their lives as carers and healthcare support workers, but also as shelf stackers, delivery drivers, and cleaners. So it's a very important article, I think. They address a lot of things which the left has been talking about recently. They also pick up some points around underfunded public services, young and old people being the biggest losers of the lockdown, and use a lot of weave this in with a lot of now more than ever, like war against the virus. We need to pull through this all together, show a bit of solidarity or a bit of stiff upper lip. And so basically the conclusion is as follows. You know, to win the peace after coronavirus, radical reforms, reversing the prevailing policy direction of the last four decades, will need to be put on the table. Governments will have to accept a more active role in the economy. They must see public services as investments rather than liabilities and look for ways to make labour markets less insecure. Redistribution will again be on the agenda, the privileges of the elderly and wealthy in question. So I guess the first thing on this is whether it's just a cynical ploy by the FT to take over Jacobins and Navarra's audiences, because so much of this could have been found in those publications. It's really striking how quickly they reach for a lot of these kind of ideas around quite fundamental reforms and really tacking away from neoliberalism into some new areas. So yeah, I mean, that's why I picked it, because I thought, yeah, we should really discuss this, because I think it also touches on some things we talked about in a couple of previous episodes as well.
It's world historic. I mean, as a, you know, and insofar as the Financial Times is one of the papers of record globally as well, not just, I mean, it's the kind of the newspaper of the capitalist class at the global level, not just for Britain. It's an astonishing, not least also because it's not an article, it's an editorial written by the editorial board. So it's the collective expression of a particular viewpoint by a very influential paper. And the most, I mean, aside from the fact, like you say, George, that it gives voice to and expresses themes that have been common on the left, it's also remarkable because it's precisely these things that the cutting against what the FT has championed without any admission whatsoever of any kind of liability or accountability for themselves. So the idea of public investments as liabilities, that's something which it would be common to any FT editorial demanding budget cutbacks and austerity for the last 10 years. And not, you know, the hostility to, now they're suggesting that we need redistribution wealth taxes, things that the FT has also been hostile to. Mm. So the unwillingness to admit fault is really striking and repellent. And on the flip side, I think the fact that they've absorbed, like you say, the kind of terrain occupied by Navarra Media and Jacobin also, I think, tells you something else, which is the essential conservatism or, conservatism and essential kind of centrism of those kinds of positions, that they're now, the FT is kind of rapidly moving to a new center ground, and that Jacobin and Navarra and et cetera are all going to be left scrabbling to find themselves to express some kind of new something in that terrain, because that's how they've defined themselves for so long.
I don't think necessarily that would be the case. I mean, obviously, you oppose neoliberalism, and then when neoliberalism ends, you move on and you tack further leftwards, if you want to put it that way. And I've seen kind of two different responses to the FT. I mean, some on the left celebrate it as if it's vindication of the left's position, which I think is a sort of misunderstanding of what's going on there. I mean, capitalism has always been flexible and has oriented towards the times, especially when it needs to take counter-crisis measures. And things which were previously thought unthinkable suddenly become plausible. I mean, that has happened through so many different changes in different capitalist regimes that, you know, it shouldn't be any surprise. But on the other hand, I don't think it should be rejected, or I'm totally fine with welcoming that. I think probably the shift to a more public capitalism as opposed to a kind of a private moment, something that's probably to be welcomed. I think it's probably a little bit more of a, I mean, maybe it's a question, whether I think it's a bit more of a fruitful terrain for the left than moments of where the state takes no responsibility for outcomes, but than one where it does.
I guess that's a question, right? What's the response going to be of the left to, I mean, if, and this is basically the thesis we advanced in the Ideologies of the Near Future episode. If the center ground is essentially state capitalism, you know, high public expenditure, high public investment, that kind of just complete ditching of Thatcherism, then what does the left do? Does the left say, okay, this is an opportunity to go further and to demand, you know, real, really radical measures? Or is it a critique on the basis of, I guess, a kind of left technocracy, or this idea of kind of technocratic do-gooderism that we explored a little bit, or progressive technocracy? There's lots of potential ways to frame it, which is essentially not saying that it's a political critique, but there's not enough, I guess, equality, or there's some failing in the way that it's being implemented, rather than it being a kind of problematic program in the first place.
Right.
I think there's another kind of dynamic, which is, I think that capitalism is being reorganized, and its tremendous kind of fragility has been exposed, obviously, as a result of the virus. And I'm sure this is something we'll return to and talk about much more. But given that capitalism is reorganizing, then the question is, and, you know, spontaneously and out of necessity, it's having to reorganize itself as a social system. Who does the left speak for? Does it speak for a social movement seeking to steer and politically shape and reorganize capitalism into a new social form? Or is it simply giving voice to something that is entirely internal to capitalism itself? And it seems to me, given that the FT now has annexed that left terrain, effectively, it seems to me it's the latter, right? That effectively the left has been expressing the need for a reorganization of capitalism. And what we'll end up with is a more technocratic, managerial, what I've called elsewhere, COVID corporatist model of capitalism. And whether or not that's better for the left or not is, you know, is an open question. But it's partly left down to political agency. But I don't think we can expect much from those leftists who are angling for jobs in a newly expanded state sector.
No, I think that's right.
Yeah.
You end up with what I think I'm calling the well actually left, which is to say that a left which is intellectually and politically completely parasitic on the new state capitalism. I don't mean that parasitic in the sense of, you know, getting sinecures and jobs and whatnot. I mean intellectually parasitic in that it doesn't express any political and intellectual independence. So yes, state capitalism, yes, we welcome this, but hey, look, maybe the impacts of it don't fall equally enough all across the population, or maybe women are left out here, or these minorities are left out here, but basically no substantial critique of the fundamentals of the kind of new political economic regime. Basically, everything's okay, but this implementation of it is just not quite fair, which would be of a piece with most of the left, especially the center left's track record over the past 20 years, which has also been to be effectively left neoliberals, trying to be sort of in-house critics to neoliberalism as much as they wouldn't conceive of themselves as such, but to basically say, yes, you know, flexibilization, okay, but what about these effects? They're unfair. We need to have a little bit more state spending to fix the, you know, fix the downsides of a free market system.
Well,
no, I think that that's it. It's basically that sort of relationship where it doesn't really offer a fundamental critique, neither to capitalism nor even to the specific regime in place, but really just says, can you just make sure that you implement this in a smarter way, listen to the best experts, or make sure you act in a moral way, that the policies are fair, basically.
So, yeah, I mean, but this is the opportunity that it presents, is that if you can get beyond that critique based on implementation, then it's necessary to critique the whole project and to say that even a more redistributive state capitalism, that's not what we want. We want political power. We don't want that kind of redistribution only. We want, you know, we want self-government. We want a bit more.
Which I think is more, I think there's more evidence of that I suppose the reasons to be hopeful isn't so much the fact that the FT is now sounding like Jacobin or Navarra. It would be more, I would more take kind of heart and interest in the stories of wildcat strikes, of workers refusing to, the case, I think it was in Detroit, where workers effectively retooled the factory. I think it was a General Motors factory, in fact, to start producing ventilators rather than the machine tools or cars that they were doing beforehand. And effectively, management went along with their decision. Workers enforcing their own rules or protesting against the failure of management to offer them safe working conditions in cramped warehouses and supermarkets. And I think also the boost to the status of labor, as opposed to the status of the values of meritocracy and entrepreneurialism that have been the dominant cultural values of the last 30 years. So if we see a greater willingness for self-assertion among workers and perhaps a greater cultural elevation of the need for dignity, autonomy, and control in the workplace, and a devaluation of meritocracy, then I think those will be positive things much more than the FT and Jacobin scrabbling for the new centre ground.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the point that you made about the FT not owning up to this and not accepting any responsibility when they say reversing the prevailing policy direction of the past four decades, that's that kind of parenthetical comment. That's like, that's this economic structure which you've defended like completely without qualification, and now you've kind of changed tack. So completely I don't think you're ever gonna get any accountability or any reckoning of people who are now saying that they've always been in favor of redistribution. They've always thought this is a good idea. I think that, but it's, that was never going to happen because they're.
It's also a question about whether we want to be holding the FT to account. I mean, whether that energy should be exerted in that direction.
Not the FT specifically, but as a general principle of democratic politics, that, you know, public, that these such views should be held to account. So, I mean, it's not specifically the FT, but in general, there should be accountability. And the FT has been tremendously politically influential over the last 40 years. So we should hold them to account for sure.
Okay, so let's move on to the next article. The next one's mine. It's actually a blog post. Wouldn't normally go for a blog post, but it was shared around so much by a lot of, left intellectuals, I guess, that I thought it was maybe worth discussing. It came out a little while ago, maybe, 3 weeks ago? It's called Herd Immunity is Epidemiological Neoliberalism. And it was published on thequarantimes.wordpress.com. The main argument is that the UK's initial approach to dealing with COVID, as well as the current strategy of Sweden and the strategy which the Netherlands was adopting until relatively recently, is neoliberal. So it's implementation of some limited social distancing measures, but no lockdown, with the idea that instead of trying to avoid people getting the disease and flattening the curve, that people would allow themselves to be infected. Those people who would need treatment get treated, but eventually immunity would spread throughout the population. We can come to the maybe some of the details of that in a second, but I think the article is problematic because, I mean, I don't even know whether I should explain more about the article in terms of what the idea is there. But basically, as listeners can probably imagine, the idea of epidemiological neoliberalism is basically, well, every man for himself. The state washes its hands of responsibility for taking measures to stop the spread of the disease, and that people, you know, it's every man for himself, basically. Which sounds plausible, except for the fact that there's a couple of holes in this. So one hole is that it argues that this neoliberal approach, of course, has happened in the most neoliberal Western economy or European economies, the UK and the Netherlands, but then it realizes that Sweden has done it too, and so says, oh, but actually Sweden's a model of social democracy, so how's that possible? Oh, but Sweden's also been doing neoliberalism, so that makes sense then. It seems a bit contradictory. I think that argument that it was the most neoliberal economies which implemented this this approach doesn't exactly hold. And then the second hole in it is that it tries to make this argument that by pursuing the herd immunity approach, effectively every man for himself, it's the government not taking responsibility. But arguably, you could say that the widespread use of lockdowns is also the government not really accepting responsibility. It's treating the disease as a natural phenomenon about which they could have done little, and therefore lockdown is the only solution, which is probably not the case. I mean, it's a fact of the lack of preparation that has been done, and this is something that we discussed in the last episode with John McAfee, who is a, if you haven't heard that yet, it's wild. John McAfee is a COVID skeptic. He doesn't think it's a big deal and that people should just get on with their lives, and this is just a big ploy by government and the media to make people scared and to take more power. I don't buy that, but I think one point is that to lock everyone down is to basically say, well, we didn't take the measures that would have been necessary beforehand. We were worried about a pandemic for 2 decades, did nothing about it, and now it's happening, and that a lockdown is the only possible response. Well, maybe now it is because the preparations weren't made beforehand, but that doesn't mean that if governments had started responding to it earlier, that maybe lockdown wouldn't be necessary to the same degree that it is now.
Yeah, I mean, it is quite striking how the only two options which have been rendered possible are either lockdown or herd immunity, both of which are not really collective the lockdown, as you said, is it is a weird way of basically saying, okay, we're going to impose these rules, and then whatever happens is your fault because you haven't been following.
Herd immunity is collective, though. I mean, by definition.
But it's, I mean, I guess the way that this article unpacks it is saying, well, there's no coordinated approach. It's a disaggregated, if it's collective, it's disaggregated because there's nobody regulating or doing anything. It's a laissez-faire social Darwinist, as the article puts it, approach, because you just let the logic of the market or the logic of individual interactions govern the outcome. So it's produced in a way that might be individually rational but collectively irrational.
Yeah, I agree with what you said, Alex, that lockdown is also a sign of a sign of political irresponsibility, and also, like you say, effectively locking, to coin a phrase, locking into place a system for 20 years, which has been founded on reorganizing health systems along market lines, as well as stripping back public investment in all sorts of infrastructure and health as well. The other thing, though, I mean, the point is, there is no way to defeat the virus without herd immunity. And the only way to get herd immunity is either by vaccination or by by ensuring that people build up their resistance.
Which we don't know. And the latter option is completely unknown. So it's possible that people don't have immunity. So everything is everything's a wager. Everything is a suboptimal response right now.
No, quite so. So, but in the interim, while we wait for, the question is then, while we're waiting for a vaccine, there's the trade-off as to how far you can, how you manage quarantine and all sorts of different medical interventions traded off against the costs, the economic costs, which by all accounts are going to be tremendous, of lockdown. And it seems to me this kind of this blog post is a very typical expression of a middle-class view on this question, where you get, the kind of the lockdown left with supported, which expresses this middle-class view. You can work from home, you get everything delivered by Deliveroo or Amazon or whatever, or Uber Eats, and it's fine. And there's something out there called the economy, which these ruthless evil capitalists, are trying to manipulate and control. And it's a matter of the economy versus life, as if everybody could work from home, as if, everyone can participate in meetings over Zoom. And that's the content of all work in the productive economy.
Yeah, One of the responses to the FT piece, which we just discussed, George's one, there was a letter published in the FT, which I actually grabbed because I thought it was interesting. One of the letters says, "My affluent, expensively educated neighbors." This is a writer, a reader of the FT writing into from San Francisco, saying, "My affluent, expensively educated neighbors regard their adherence to the public health protocols almost as an act of civic heroism. They seem only faintly aware that an army of ordinary people, from police officers to bank tellers to delivery drivers, make their home confinement possible," which I thought exemplified very well what you were just saying. I think this idea that the lockdown is both heroic, anti-neoliberal, and a kind of optimal outcome or something is weird. On the other hand, I think the idea of rebelling against the lockdown right now, when it's probably the best option in the immediate term, is also kind of probably, it's also misguided.
So Zizek made a similar point whilst touching his face quite frequently in an interview.
Face, you could don't see. Touch his face, Slavoj.
Yeah, well, he needs to learn. But yeah, of course, I think a lot of the people who are writing these kind of articles, not just the blog that we're discussing, but opinion pieces or lockdown experience pieces more generally, are those who are privileged, who are able to be confined to quarantine at home and actually have things, not like normal, but like an extended working from home period. You know, if the office is being refurbished and there's just some you know, reason why you have to get your groceries delivered from Ocado rather than going down to the local shop, then that's the, I think a lot of people have generalized from that experience which they've had and thought that's the common experience that everybody is having. But in fact, there's not a singular kind of response to this.
The fantasy also that it could actually be extended. So the idea, you know, the lockdown left kind of pressures government, well, just put everyone at home and put everyone on the state payroll. And that's the way to solve this crisis. It doesn't eradicate the virus. So lockdown only delays the spread of the virus. And also, you can't actually have an entire economy of people who work from home. It's just not possible. So, I mean, I think the, you know, the other aspect of this is this vision of the economy as, like I said, as if it's something separate from society itself. You know, the process of productive work is actually society itself. It's not just the kind of the realm of the economy, as if the realm is just kind of, you know, as if the economy is just stockbrokers gouging us. That's not it at all. And productive work and being, you know, delivering food and, I don't know, cleaning stuff and working from home and all that kind of stuff is actually the stuff of society itself. So locking down economies on this scale, I mean, the economy is vaporizing, literally. You know, there's like somebody, I think it was Justin Morris, the economist, said about, he estimated about 0.5 percentage point of GDP for every week, I think it was, in America.
Oof.
Yeah.
So the economy is literally vaporizing with lockdown. And I have to disagree with you, Alex. I think there are options. Even if we could only apply them belatedly now of trying to isolate and quarantine the most vulnerable, throwing enormous amounts of resources at them and also at expanding medical capacity. And it seems to me that's what we should do, because the costs of this, of the coming economic crash, are going to overwhelm, I think, the costs of COVID in the long run.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think the main thing is just that the polarization between pro-lockdown and anti-lockdown is the wrong way to think about this.
I think that's right.
Because it ends up polarizing between a couple of kind of cranky right-wingers, nut jobs, a bunch of, you know, right wing pro business types who are like, well, I'm losing profit, we can't lock down now, which you know, that just in a very narrow self interested way, and kind of wacko libertarians versus everyone else who then goes, well, if all these wackos are anti lockdown, that means that lockdown is probably a good idea, and that polarization isn't helpful because it isn't even thinking creatively about what solutions are necessary, what's possible, what are the risks and costs involved to all of this in the way that you've just spelled out, Phil, and not just seeing the economy. Sure, I mean, there's lots of inessential workers, lots of especially middle class professionals who are working from home and whose jobs obviously have been proven not to be essential. But many people who are being de facto marched into work because they have no other option, and they need to keep keep the economy going.
It's quite a realization that your job is not essential. As mine is, that that's the reality, right? You do realize that you are not, I'm speaking about myself here, not directly involved in actually producing or distributing any commodities.
Yeah,
you know,
I was just about to do things with documents. Just cut you off from the podcast entirely.
I'm not an essential part of the podcast
or distributing. You're just.
No, I mean, no, that's
Alpha
it, though.
Banga Banga is essential, though. I'm sure that's true.
Culture is essential. That's what people who work in culture industries like to argue. So, it's quite striking, right?
Most strikingly, we've talked about this elsewhere, though we haven't talked about it on the pod, but the fact that both Congress and Parliament have deemed themselves inessential, because they decided that they aren't going to sit and hold to account the executive in a time of national emergency. So they've basically deemed the fact their jobs as democratically elected representatives to be legislators and to hold the executive to account is simply inessential. And that's the most astonishing thing of all, I think. And also it's part of the same 40 years of neoliberalism that the FT was cutting against. supposedly, is also this idea of seeing politics itself as effectively inessential, because everything can be left to the spontaneous order of the market.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Maybe we should move on to the third article, which is a little bit more out there. Phil.
It's the dessert.
Yes. So this is a piece in Slate called We're on the Brink of Cyberpunk by Kelsey D. Atherton. And I came across it on Twitter, and I thought it would be, I thought it would be good to throw into the mix because it's of a different kind from so much of the other Corona commentary. To get away from, there's so many kind of the latest paper that's been published. These stats, how applicable the statistics in one region, say Wuhan, are as opposed to the statistics coming out of Sweden, as opposed to those coming out of New York, death rates versus infection, so many. So to get away a bit from that and to kind of cast it or to look at it, I suppose, from the perspective, from a more cultural perspective or literary perspective, I thought I would bring this into the mix. So what it does is it basically talks about how what we're going through at the moment is the dystopia imagined in an earlier period, and how much what we're going through with lockdown and also the disease and responses to it resonate with the dystopias of cyberpunk. And it reminds us all, in fact, that the original Blade Runner movie directed by Ridley Scott with Harrison Ford that came out in the late 70s, was it? It was set in November 2019, which we've passed. The future that it, the kind of dystopian Los Angeles that it presented to us, was in November 2019. But it goes through some other dystopias. And a few interesting things that it mentions are the overwhelming evidence of corporate power in these various dystopian sci-fi visions, either in film or in books, Neuromancer being another one, and in which there is no existence of politics. There's no, apart from the police to maintain order, and typically the police are corrupt or ineffectual. The other thing that's very interesting, though, is something that it mentions is also the fact that the form that resistance takes in these dystopias tends to be direct action. So it's not really collective or political. It's more or involving kind of, built around some kind of clear political principles or around some kind of clear political organization, but tends to be kind of very small scale or activist style revolt and insurrection. And I thought that was really striking, and whether the connection between the neoliberal world that we're living in, with overwhelming corporate power, kind of shriveled centers of political power, and at the same time the resistance to that world is also entirely part of it, because it's also to a degree apolitical. And if you think about the kinds of rebels that are portrayed in some of these dystopian scenarios, they tend to be either quite hippie-ish, or if they're not peaceful, they're kind of Bader-Meinhof-y. Their political principles are all quite obscure. In the background, their organizational structures isn't really ever mentioned. You think about, say, the rebels in, Children of Men, for instance, or in Johnny Mnemonic, or in Blade Runner itself, right? It's kind of a small, isolated group of slave androids who have no kind of political aim apart from trying to prolong their lives. So anyway, I thought that was interesting. And then just one final point, which is the author also mentions in the piece the popularity of steampunk as well, and saying that steampunk is the kind of idea of mixing a Victorian kind of late 19th century aesthetic with technology, more advanced technology than the Victorians had. And what it says, the popularity of steampunk reflects the fact that we're in a second Gilded Age, or we're just exiting a second Gilded Age, because the late 19th century was similar to ours in many respects in terms of the enormous inequalities of wealth, the lavish conspicuous consumption of the privileged, and how there's echoes of that in the popularity of steampunk harking back to the previous Gilded Age. Anyway, what did you guys think of it?
No, I thought it was it made me think about I guess that point around the absence of politics in in cyberpunk in general, because this is one of the points that the article makes, is that that's the big difference between a cyberpunk scenario and contemporary life, in that you have vast corporate power, persistent surveillance, life in a time of constant crisis in both cases, but it's the painful awareness of politics and of the presence or deliberate absence of government in daily life. That's what distinguishes today from the cyberpunk dystopia, that kind of 80s feeling. And I think it is, for many people, myself included, quite clear how technology mediates all of our social relations day by day anyway. But it's just now so obvious that the only way that we interact with people, or one of the only ways, is through Zoom pub quizzes, or, you know, speaking on Skype or things like that. So it definitely, I think it sort of had some resonance in saying, right, what is the applicability of cyberpunk to today?
Yeah, I didn't really know what to make of this piece, and maybe I'm just not au fait enough with cyberpunk literature to really, and other media to really bring it to
life. But you've seen the movies. I've
seen movies. I've seen a couple of movies in my life.
Like Blade Runner, Children of Men.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I just don't know what to make of it in terms of our contemporary reality, or what it seems to be projecting into the future, right? Because I guess what it would suggest is this kind of state corporate dystopia, right, where state and corporate are hand in hand, which they were in the neoliberal period, but would be maybe even more so now with the state assuming more direct authority. Point. Yeah.
But I think it was portraying, so it was, you know, cyberpunk kind of emerged in the early 1980s, and that it was portraying, it was extrapolating the future. So it's very much a genre that was shaped by neoliberalism and portraying a future in which politics and the state had kind of been stripped back just to pure enforcement of order. And you had enormous kind of corporate power, like the huge ziggurat corporate headquarters, which are portrayed at the start of Blade Runner in the opening shot.
Yeah, and I think that's the point, isn't it? That it hits something, like cyberpunk as a dystopia, hit on something which is now becoming apparent has happened over the past 40 years, and that's the hollowing out of the state and its reduction essentially to just constraining people's, in this case, constraining people's movement. So you do see that big gap. I don't think that corporate power really, I mean, obviously that in dramatized versions like Blade Runner of 2019, there has to be a kind of an opposition and a single hero who can change things. Otherwise, I don't know where the dramatic sort of tension comes from, but certainly the absence of the state in its ability to solve citizens' problems has been pretty clearly illustrated by the past month.
There isn't even politics, though. There isn't even corrupt politicians doing, you know, kind of enforcing corporate orders. It's just completely invisible. Or there isn't kind of there isn't a place for a kind of well-meaning, limp-wristed liberals to try, who are kind of ineffectually trying to resolve problems that require a more radical. So, you know, there's just none of that even figures in the story. Mm-hmm. It's the kind of monadic, isolated, small-scale groups pursuing kind of heroic insurrections, and on the other side, just enormous kind of concentrations of economic power and privilege. It's interesting because I think it does speak to, you know, it is something of the dystopia that we're living through, to some degree at least. So Los Angeles doesn't, in Blade Runner, doesn't look like the real Los Angeles, but the neo, you know, the kind of the state failure that we're seeing, particularly in the US and the UK, speak to that kind of aspect of neoliberalism, and the fact that the left itself, you know, in terms of Occupy, anti-globalization, Black Bloc, all of that stuff over the 1990s in particular was very much in keeping with the anti or post-political character of the times as well.
Sorry, go on.
Well, no, just, and then there's been a sort of rediscovery of politics in the latter half of the 2010s, right? Which now, you know,
left populism
returned to the party form, albeit in kind of modified sort of ways, which has now also reached its tail. So,
yeah, depressing.
Depressing, and I think we maybe leave this episode there.
I just had one final point, which is doesn't really add to the discussion, but just this idea of the cyber bourgeoisie, which is a good neologism, which I hadn't heard before, and I think it's an interesting kind of part of the article talking about this idea of plutocratic insurgency and the wealthy seeking to sort of carve out de facto zones of autonomy for themselves, precisely by crippling, undermining the state's ability to constrain their freedom of action. And this, I mean, that's essentially what's happened, that you have the ultra rich being able to solve this problem for themselves quite easily by decamping to their second, third, whatever number home, which is sufficiently detached and maybe has a doomsday prepper kind of store of beans and
I think it's more than beans there, because there was that story in the New York Post of all the rich Manhattanites who fled New York to the Hamptons decamped.
It's peanut butter. You need peanut butter, according to John McAfee.
But I mean, I think I don't think the rich of Manhattan are taking their guidance from John McAfee on that, because some of the stories coming out of this kind of stuff that they took with them to the Hamptons and the kind of stuff that they're ordering in to that place is also it was the Hamptons, wasn't it? Or was it somewhere else? Anyway, wherever they fled to, they're definitely not prepping with cans of baked beans.
Yeah, well, speaking of insurrection, the last episode, there was a lot of talk about people taking arms, or rather the disappointment that John McAfee felt in people not having taken up arms against the state during the lockdown. We are back next week with a free episode in which we also talk about taking up arms, or rather, what are the consequences of not having been armed? We're talking to Vincent Bevins about his new book called The Jakarta Method, about Cold War violent anti-communism. So that's next week. Later on, towards the end of the following week, we have our reading group for patrons $10 and up, where we will be discussing... George, what are we discussing?
So yeah, we'll be discussing Evgeny Morozov's Digital Socialism, which was in the New Left Review last year, so March, June 2019, which is a really good thing to revisit or to visit if you haven't read it.
So we'll be making that available to the patrons $10 and up. We look forward to receiving your questions and comments and points for us to discuss, which that episode will come out right at the very end of the month. Catch you later. Thanks for listening. Take care of each other. Bye-bye.